The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Money Show proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that has the bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That is Africanacity. And we've got a special broadcast this evening. You wouldn't believe it. You may believe it now, from the Equinox, which is a phenomenal event space deep in the headquarters of Absa Corporate and Investment Bank in Sandton. Stephen Van Koller, the former chief executive of the Absa Corporate and Investment Bank, once told me they call this Stephen's Folly. That's what they say. He told me they call it. But it's a fabulous space. Maybe it just doesn't get used enough. But it is a good space to be used, and we're making full use of it this evening. Commemorating what we start is going to be the hope, what we hope will be a long and fruitful partnership with the brand, as the long-term anchor sponsor for The Money Show. We're chatting this evening to Charles Russon, who's the chief executive of Absa CIB, as we look ahead to tomorrow's interest rates announcement, ahead to tonight's US interest rates announcement, which frankly is more important than our own in terms of the global economy. US is slowing down quite significantly. We'll talk to Mike Schussler at economists.co.za. He is worried that we're just simply not going to have enough money in the kitty to run the country at the time of the medium-term budget policy statement. And the impact it's going to have on your finances, as Tito Mboweni takes his hand and digs it even deeper into your pockets as the tax burden rises on individuals. Patrick Matidi is going to be our market commentator tonight on a day where Richemont found itself downgraded by UBS in Europe. Andrew Woodburn of Woodburn Man, he's going to be joining us, trying to find CEOs to run the SOEs and other acronyms tonight. We're months and months into the search for the SAA CEO. I saw the former SAA CEO Vuyani Jahana the other day at an event. It was happened to be the day that they published the advert for his job. I asked him if he wanted it back, and he disappeared. I don't know where he went, but he's gave a very clear indication that he wasn't that interested. Plus, we need an Eskom chief executive as well as we head towards a summer of potential load shedding. And then the great story that has taken South Africa by storm over the last couple of weeks, the America's Got Talent superstars, the Ndlovu Youth Choir. We'll talk about their future and what that means. I'm hoping that Absa Corporate and Investment Bank has booked them for their end-of-year Christmas party, and if not, why not? We'll be asking questions about that this evening. Colin Cullis with Business Unusual, and Wendy Nola, our consumer ninja, is going to be with us tonight as well, talking about the elderly and the way they get treated by financial services companies. Your fingerprints too will fade one day, and biometrics will become a challenge. So all of that tonight, plus the fantastic story of Feltskuns. That's all coming up on this live edition of The Money Show from the Absa CIB headquarters in Sandton.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking.
That's them sucking up to the boss. Charles Russon is the chief executive of Absa Corporate and Investment Bank of CIB. Tonight's American interest rate decision that's been done by the Fed at about 8 o'clock South Africa time is actually probably more important than whatever Lesitja Khanyako has to say about South Africa tomorrow.
Well, first of all, Bruce, let me say welcome. It's fantastic to have you here.
Why is he buying time? Why is he sucking up? Why is he saying, what is he afraid of? Answer the question, man.
And nice to have you. In terms of the decision making in tomorrow, I think in terms of today's CPI coming out, I think this it came in marginally higher than was expected. But actually, I don't think there's any reason personally why there can't be a rate cut. I know the markets are anticipating 60% chance of remaining the same. But I think in terms of what the country needs, and I'm not saying that that will solve all our ills, I don't think there's any impediment to moving forward.
Two potential impediments, 4.3% on CPI, being driven higher by food. And of course, after transport and accommodation, food is a big cost for most families in South Africa. And that is a big increase coming through on the food cost, but also the oil price. I mean, just a drone attack in Saudi Arabia over the weekend takes the oil price up 10% overnight, Sunday night. And suddenly the outlook changes from having a 10 cents a litre cut at the next petrol price announcement. We go to a 50 cents a litre increase potentially. And that does begin to change things a bit, doesn't it?
Absolutely. For the consumer, petrol price increase like that is clearly painful for all of us. But I do think as we look at it, I think you've seen oil coming back down today. I think it was somewhere around 63 at this present moment in time. I do think the US this evening at 8 o'clock, I think they are, in all likelihood, I think they're going to cut rates.
Now, I was on your trading floor this afternoon. I was given free rein. It was
pressing
terrifying.
Buttons.
I wasn't allowed to touch any buttons, and I can't understand why. I mean, it says buy and sell. It's not that complicated. But I was prevented. I was restrained. And they were talking about even a 50 basis point cut in the United States. And that was causing a little bit of uncertainty. And if the American, if the U.S. Fed did that, that would be an admission that the U.S. economy was in serious trouble. And Donald Trump, on the one hand, would have to welcome a big fat interest rate cut, but then would have to admit that his policies aren't working.
Well, I think that would be true. I think it might, some of that might be wishful thinking on part of some of our traders, but I think there will be a 25 basis point cut with a fairly dovish outlook as we go into the future. I think they've got one eye on the global economy and then clearly the other eye certainly on the US. I don't think it's in the kind of position that you implying there, but I certainly do think we're going to get a 25 basis point cut.
Thank you to Charles Russon. Don't move, Charles. I may need to talk to you again in a moment. Charles is the chief executive at APSA CIB. On the line to us now from Joburg, the chief economist at economists.co.za, Mike Schussler. He joins us on the line. And for the first time since the big recession, 2008-2009, Mike Schussler, you're seeing that VAT receipts are falling. So even though we had that 1 percentage point increase in VAT last year, you are seeing that the VAT numbers are coming under pressure, and that is probably the surest indicator that this economy is in trouble.
Yes, absolutely. I think if you're looking at the VAT, you know, had a very big increase last year due to the 1% increase in VAT, in the VAT rate, 1 percentage point increase in the VAT rate, and that made that jump. And now VAT is flat. You know, the VAT rate didn't change, and for the last 6 months, the year-on-year in a smooth six-month moving average, VAT has been decreasing. Company taxes are also decreasing for 8 months or so now. This is the second time that they've decreased since the Great Recession, and both of these decreases are in nominal terms, so it doesn't take into account the impact of inflation.
So the burden then goes on to you and me and everybody in this room, anyone who gets a salary, because PAYE, of course, is a critical part of what fills up the coffers of the country. And Tito Mboweni, going into his medium-term budget policy statement in the next month or so, is going to have to find a rabbit. That rabbit could very well be personal taxes.
Yes, I think personal taxes are growing at 8.2%, although the number of jobs we know from everywhere else hasn't really been growing. And people aren't getting 8% salary increases. What's happening is it's bracket creep. So essentially you get a 6% salary increase or a 5% salary increase, but you go to the next bracket. You go from 18 to 25% tax or from 25 to 33% tax. And the Treasury estimated that it was about a 12 billion rand that they would gain from not adjusting fully for inflation. And specifically at the higher end, there's been no adjustment for 4 or 5 years on the 708,000 rand level, and then per year, and then obviously the 1.5 million came in between and was actually an increase, but that's also now, you know, 2 years behind us, and this is still growing.
But let's cut to the chase here, Mike. I mean, let's cut to the really important bits here, and that is that the only part of the tax take that is growing is personal income taxes. It's probably the only part of the market that the finance minister can lean on. Does he start giving indications that he gives us a 3-year perspective at the next medium-term budget policy statement, but that we have to see personal taxes increase, even though South Africa, relative to the rest of the world, is a very, very heavily taxed country?
Yeah, so we are definitely in the top 10 regarding the tax burden on personal taxes, for sure. There's no doubt in my mind that it's going to increase even more. But it's of the four big taxes, only two are growing, and that's the fuel tax and personal income tax. And just to give you an 11-year view, personal taxes made up 32% of the big four, and now they're 44%. So how much higher can we take personal taxes? But it is going to have to go higher. But ultimately, you know, at some stage, it also starts interfering and people will not want to spend. And it already does interfere in the sense when you take home less, you also spend less. So it's probably one of the reasons why the VAT rate is declining, because people are buying down, if you wish.
Mike Schuster, I thank you very much for joining us this evening. Chief Economist at economist.co.za. Back to Charles Russon, ABSA CIB Chief Executive. I mean, Mike's painting a really gloomy picture of a South African economy that's not performing. We know this. We've had downgrades from everybody in terms of the expectations of growth for 2019. The economy isn't growing. We're not seeing the VAT receipts going up. There's a bit coming through in petrol. There's a bit coming through in personal income taxes. Is there any magic left in this? Yeah, it's the genie fast asleep. Is Tito Mboweni going to be able to find a sort of a magic opportunity in the medium-term budget policy statement, do you think?
And Bruce, you're asking me that question.
I'm hoping that you can give him an answer, because Mike Schuster has just challenged him to raise taxes by even more, so we're hoping he doesn't.
Look, I think the key for us as a country is we've somehow got to find growth. If this pond keeps shrinking, and remember, the population's increasing, and whether you believe the GDP... increase rate of whatever 0.6.
Yeah,
everyone's getting poorer ultimately. That's the challenge that we've got as a country at this present moment. So somehow we've got to find a way of getting growth into this economy. And I think we need policy certainty, policy stability, and that creates the business environment, a friendly business environment where we can actually do things.
The finance minister published, very controversially 3 weeks ago, a discussion document, and very few members of the public have actually bothered to contribute to the discussion other than whinging on Twitter, which is not contributing to the discussion. Have you contributed directly as CIB, as APSA, to this discussion document to say we like this, we don't like this?
Well, we're certainly going through it, and we will provide our feedback around it. I think... as we look at it, at least there's something out there on the table. Maybe they skip some of the processes to putting it out there and getting it out in a hurry. But at least there's something now we can work to. And I think we need some decisions. And I think that's the most fundamental part.
Well, as the finance minister said, and he's a bit of a lone voice on this, it's time to shake the baobab tree. And it is time to shake that tree, is it not?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much to Charles Russon this evening, the Chief Executive of APSA CIB. In a moment, in studio with us this evening at APSA's Corporate Investment Bank is Patrick Matidi from Aluwani Capital Partners. He'll give us a perspective on today's market activity. 2 days in a row now of quite significant declines. The JSE did close above 26,000 on the all-share index, but for the second day in a row, we saw both Prosus and Naspers pull back quite sharply, and there was a warning on luxury goods in Europe. That hurt Richemont on the day. Pick up on that in a moment.
The Money Show. The Markets.
Patrick Matidi from Aluwani Capital Partners is our market commentator tonight on a day that the JSE slipped 1.25%, pretty much the same sort of decline as we saw yesterday. Monday was so promising. We were in la-la land, and la-la land can sometimes be a happy place to be, but 2 days of sharp declines on our market left us just above the 56,000 on the all-share index. We've been talking about the US Fed decision. We've been talking about South African inflation. All of these things do matter when it comes to overall long-term trends on the market. Just give me a feel about what you seeing in the US tonight and South African interest rate decision tomorrow, Patrick?
Look, I think I'll stick with the consensus. I think we'll get a cut later on this evening out of the Fed. I think also there is, you know, a decent chance that we get one domestically tomorrow.
Yeah, is there a decent chance?
Yeah, I think there's a decent chance. I think there are signs that indeed, you know, inflation is under control. So it's sticking around sort of the middle of the range, between the 3 to 6% range, which is about 4.5 or so. And the outlook, you know, barring a few sporadic sort of variables, assuming that those are, you know, transitionary, another was they will stabilize the things like the oil price, for example, there is a good chance that indeed we get a rate cut tomorrow.
I certainly hope you're right. I mean, the Reserve Bank are a conservative bunch of guys, but they've got some new governors. Maybe the new governors be more malleable to the needs of the economy and the needs of the economy to give us a bit of a boost. Another 25 basis point cut would be very, very welcome indeed. Retail sales, not doing brilliantly, but holding up. I mean, they're treading water, not drowning yet, but not exactly flying.
No, not exactly flying. And also, I mean, there's a bit of a decoupling between the national retail sales numbers and what we are picking up from the actual listed retailers.
What does that mean, a decoupling?
So, you know, what you see at the headline level is not always a fair reflection of actually what's happening within the retail listed space. So if you just look at the last few months, you know, your big retailers have actually been on the back foot, indicating that things are a bit tough out there. The consumer is under a lot of strain. And perhaps it's more your independents that are not listed, that are actually playing at a lower price points that are still grabbing market share from your big incumbents.
Well, I mean, at least there's activity. We'll take any activity that we can at the moment. Richemont, they came on a lot of pressure today, fell about 6%. UBS in Switzerland, they came out with a report talking about the luxury goods market. They're ideally positioned to talk about it. And they actually downgraded Richemont today, which explains that huge drop.
Yeah, we also saw, you know, a bit of weakness across the sectors globally. So the likes of Swatch, for example, in Switzerland also did come down. But if you look at the last few weeks, at least, you know, you've had these ongoing protests in Hong Kong. So that is a gateway into the Chinese market, where we do see a lot of sales, especially for the likes of Richemont, that comes through from that region. So to the extent that UBS, the likes of UBS, for example, see that as ongoing, I suppose that does put a damper on luxury sales going forward. But our view is that that should reverse at some point. There should be some settlement, and then hopefully that top end of the market, as we've seen over the last while, does tend to be a bit more resilient.
Talk to me about the coal market. I mean, there are no direct coal listings on the JSE, really, but it's been a massively controversial sector, the Eskoms and the Guptas and all of these sorts of issues. Lots of people scrambling now for the exits. Coal is this big global pariah. Yeah. We're seeing lots of proposed empowerment deals being done with coal. And today, we see Sasol talking about it getting out of coal, which is a huge break from the very commodity that made Sasol Sasol. It was they were the first ones to extract oil from coal. They're divorcing from coal now too, suggests that there's a massive sea change happening.
Look, to be fair, I didn't see much confirmation from Sasol with regards to that story. I think it is mere speculation, but nevertheless...
Usually speculation precedes the fact. So, I mean, it seems like a pretty good piece of speculation.
Absolutely. So, but Sasol themselves have actually come out in the past and said that they are looking at divesting from non-core assets. It doesn't quite make sense for me from a coal plant point of view, because you still need the input into your plants. And also, if you look at Sasol themselves, they needed about 38 million tons or so per annum of input into feedstock into the plants. So security of supply is actually crucial. And I'm not sure you want to actually sell that away and give it to someone else, just given how strategic that input is into your business.
But they're going to get rid of non-core assets. I mean, there's a thing in Louisiana called Lake Charles. I don't know how core that is. And it's, they're struggling to bring that to book, of course. And then EOH. Oh, my goodness me. Stephen von Koller, who used to run this building, went into the lion's den at EOH. And a big warning from them today, have massive losses. Is this what they call kitchen sinking? Throw everything at the company and get rid of all the problems quickly?
I think they are throwing a lot into it, but I think there's still a bit more. They did announce, actually, that the cost of the investigation by ENS, those are still to come. So it's not clear yet as to the quantum, but certainly that won't be a good number coming through in terms of overall profitability. But I guess you need to take a long-term view and say, is this the end? Is this the bottom? Has it done enough to clean up? And therefore, is this, a decent base to grow off going forward?
And what is the answer to that question? You can't ask a question, then not give an answer.
Look, there are a lot of moving parts, especially with regards to EOH. It is a fairly complex business. Stephen has been trying over the last while to actually simplify it and also sell non-core assets. But in a situation where you are dealing with collusion and fraud, it's very difficult to actually get a true sense as to where the bottom is, because a lot can still come out, especially when there is still a pending investigation on the go.
Patrick Matidi from Aluwani Capital Partners, thank you very much for coming in. Patrick is tonight's market commentator.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that has the bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That's Africanacity.
Welcome to The Money Show. We are live at Absa Corporate and Investment Bank. We're talking about the hiring sector this evening. We're talking about the state of the employment industry in South Africa. Andrew Woodburn from AmRop Woodburn Mann. We got you in here to talk about CEOs and SOEs. So let's talk about that first, because I also want to talk to you tonight, if you can, on the brain drain. We get very, very clear suggestions that there's a strong brain drain. We get these in cycles from time to time, but there's a big outflow of talent at the moment. We need to talk about that as well. But why have we not yet got a CEO for SAA, for Eskom, for example, for the airports company South Africa? They're acting CEOs. We've got more actors in state-owned enterprises than we do in Hollywood right now.
Bruce, thanks. It's wonderful to be here tonight. Long and the short of it, I'd say that our senior executive talent pool is fairly gun-shy at the moment on these big SOE roles. They certainly can see the writing on the wall. They understand the scale of the task, And to be honest, when you look at the opportunity versus what else they have outside of the SOE environment, most of the heavy hitters, to be honest, have a small giggle about the opportunity to go in and help the state because, for a number of reasons, it's not attractive. Primarily, the CEO does not have his mandate free and established to go about his business as he sees fit. There's
so
continuous interruption.
If you are a CEO, potential talent to go and take over at Eskom, for example, and you're currently running a large retail business, let's talk Graham Patterson, who was on his way one day for an interview to be CEO, and I think Makokochela got that job that time. He was told, don't bother coming for the interview, we've got our guy. He's an electrical engineer. He's a guy who could go into an Eskom and turn it around, given the opportunity to do so, but he would rather deal with the 20 billion rands with the debt that Eskom has got than the 450 billion that Eskom's got.
Because the lines on the playing field don't move. So he can play within those lines that he knows well. He can apply all the tricks of the trade that he knows, and he's given the mandate to fix the problem.
Are you suggesting that we're not going to get the very best caliber chief executive talent then going for the job at SOEs?
Well, I appeal to the chair and the minister. When the patient's on the table requiring open heart surgery, bring the very best surgeon we've got. The very best.
But the very best surgeons don't want the job, though. The best, they've got their private clients. They don't need public sector clients.
So you've got to come to the party with what they're asking you. You've got to give them some form of guarantee that here's the mandate, here's our requirements from you, give it your best shot. You know, and let's look at the post office, for example. I know you've had Mark on the show plenty of times, but there was an individual who was almost given a dead horse, right?
Yeah.
And he released the debt. He worked with the unions. He reduced the backlog. He changed the business model to bring revenue flows into the opportunity through the SASA disbursements. And to be honest, the last and most important thing, if you ask Mark, is he empowered the people with him to begin to be ready to take over from him. And so I would say, in general, the post office may well be, along with Telkom, one of the few case studies of where this has worked. But right now, SAA, SABC, Eskom, and I can go on with some smaller ones, certainly are a challenge and a mountain that looks pretty high for most people to climb.
So how are we going to get people into these jobs then? One, they're going to need guarantees that they will have sufficient rein to do what they need to do in their executive jobs, and that seems unlikely based on the level of interference that happens in these SOE environments. They've got to be paid properly, and they've got to have an incentive scheme in place. And that's kind of hard for government to do as the shareholder in these entities, particularly with a very strong union movement.
Alternatively, they've got to be unique individuals. In some cases, like Patterson, like Mark Barnes and others, they may not necessarily need to work. That's the key. And therefore, you can't buy them. In other words, you can't capture them because that's not on the table.
Yep.
And they're doing this for a bigger legacy reason. This is their gift back to the state, back to the nation, back to nation building, because they understand that unless they go and lift the baton, we're all in trouble.
Have you put names forward? I mean, you're in this game. I'm not going to ask you for names, but have you put names forward? Have you spoken to people about applying for these jobs?
Yes, I have. I've done a number of them in the past, so certainly I have a view on who should do it and who could do it and why. The pool is small, and certainly the minister and the chair are busy going through a process now to determine who might be their candidate. And for Eskom, for example, that's a unique role because if they do end up unbundling it, if we can use a private sector word for a state entity, into the three operating entities, to be honest, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. It has a hard stop, and therefore, you know, one would hope in that mandate your chance of success is dramatically increased.
Talk to me about the brain drain more broadly, because we get a very clear indication, and Edward Kiswetter has admitted it on the show, the SARS commissioner. I'm trying to get numbers out of government, and government either won't give me or hasn't got the numbers because the data is just too unreliable. But he was telling me he's worried about the outflow of senior people, people who pay their taxes, who are taking their earning capability elsewhere. Just how big a problem have we got?
Bruce, I've termed this brain drain 2.0. We are right plumb center in the middle. From your late 20s who are IT orientated, who've got the technical skills, I can tell you now, New Zealand for certain is targeting wonderful talent in South Africa. They can offer them a different lifestyle, a different earning agenda, a different social security system, you name it. There is that's one new destination that's come up on the radar beyond the other average ones that have always been there. I would say it's an increase in both an outflow driven as well as an attractive driven mix. And when that happens, of course, it's touchdown. The flow begins. Having said it, I have to say to you that I've been part of bringing two executives back to South Africa in this very weird, very fluid skills environment, and both senior executives, both ex-South Africans, who are willing to put up their hand and say there's some great opportunities for me here and I want to come and put my shoulder to the wheel and make things happen.
But so, the balance is skewed towards us.
Yes, yeah. I mean, Brain Drain 2.0, we're right in it, and CEOs, chairmen, NOMCOs and others are really having to bite on their knuckles to figure out how do we solve the problem.
So you must be a busy guy, because as people leave the executive suite, they've got to be replaced, and people like yourselves who are in the talent hunting competition place these people in new opportunities. It's manna from heaven for you, isn't it?
Maybe. Look, it's a tough environment. In election years and in constrained economic performance years, certainly the employment market tightens up. Companies have less money to spend. They're betting on lower level projects. They're more risk averse, so they don't go to the market to buy heavy hitting candidates that they pay a lot of money. It's all about cost containment. In which case, when someone leaves, some cases in the short term, it's a blessing in disguise, because we've just contained our costs without having to try too hard. But in the medium to long term, you're going to hurt.
What is it doing to the talent pool in South Africa, though? Are we seeing a significant dumbing down of the talent pool?
That's a difficult question to answer. I think that where there is talent, it's in high demand and it has greater opportunity, and that works right across the age range. There are 60-something-year-olds who've got great opportunities who will put their shoulders to the wheel and make brilliance happen. There are 35-year-old young black in the middle of the middle management game who are getting opportunities they would have never had otherwise. But it's hard for a 35-year-old to do a 47-year-old's job. 12 years of experience makes a massive differential. And that's where that experience prevents making what I call schoolboy errors and holds risk in a contained fashion. And we're not very good at that right now.
Are we hitting a crisis point in terms of South African talent?
I would say we are. I would say we are on a massive demand-based environment with a severely constrained supply on talent. So it's what we would call a seller's market. And that leads to many unintended consequences for talent offerers. In other words, be careful of job hopping. Really learn to manage your career strategically. Do not make the short-term decision, which I see many executives doing. And then on the end, be very careful of your ethics and morals. We're looking at certain financial institutions really grappling with both conflict of interest, moral-based decisions, so much so it goes to court. Be very careful you don't land up in that kind of environment, both as an employer, because your brand as an employer brand will suffer, and as the employee, because your personal reputation is almost irredeemable.
Andrew Woodburn, he is the chief executive of Amrop Woodburn Man, talking about the outflow of talent from South Africa, particularly to New Zealand, and also the search for SOE chief executives. We will put their hands up for the job, and if the people put their hands up for the job, are they going to be the ones who get the jobs in South Africa come 2020? Because we need all the help that we can get. Andrew, thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure, Bruce.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by the bank that has the bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. Absa Corporate and Investment Banking.
If 6 months ago you booked your Christmas gig, the choir to come to your concert, and you booked the Ndlovu Youth Choir, people would have said, who? You booked a choir for our end-of-year party? What kind of party organizer are you? And then they've taken America's Got Talent by storm, and last night they performed a spectacular version, a cover of Toto's Africa. Let's have a quick listen to this before we talk about the prospects for the Ndlovu Youth Choir, whether they win tonight or not, because at 2 o'clock tomorrow morning, we find out how they have done in America's Got Talent. They've done brilliantly. Have a listen to their performance last night. Is that going to be good enough? Is that going to be good enough to make them win America's Got Talent? I mean, does it really matter whether they win America's Got Talent or not? They've won the hearts of America and America's Got Talent. They've got to the finals of America's Got Talent. They performed like superstars last night. Was it enough to make them win the competition? Does it really matter? Roddy Quinn is the music manager at Real Concerts. I mean, these guys have been spectacular, Roddy. Have you got them on your books? Are you signing them up? Have you got them lined up for gigs from here to next year?
I really wish they were mine. I think what they've done is, it's unbelievable. And what they've done for South Africa is just, it's incredible. I don't think people realize what it means for a group from anywhere in the world to get to that point with such an amazing, enormous viewership and against such, you know, enormous talent from around the world. And these kids have got up there and done it. It's just absolutely incredible, and it's worth so much to South Africa. You can't put, you cannot put a rand value to what they've done for South African culture, for people, looking into South Africa, because what they've done is absolutely incredible.
I mean, they feel like a 2019 version of Ladysmith Black Mambazo. I mean, the feel was very similar last night. The tone was very similar. And Ladysmith Black Mambazo became global superstars after tying up with Paul Simon, of course. Is this the Ndlovu Youth Choir's great big global opportunity?
Absolutely it is. And I think, you know, Ladysmith were just incredible in their time and what they've done. But I think this represents a completely new, fresh part of South Africa. When I first saw that, I hadn't even heard of them to be honest. I saw them when America's Got Talent. I thought, oh my gosh, this is unbelievable. And they've just got better and better and better. So I think, you know, it's in this business, there's talent and there's luck. You've got to be at the right place at the right time. They have both. They have the talent and they're at the right place at the right time. So, I mean, this is going to open millions of doors for them, and they absolutely deserve it. And so does, I think, the guy that Ralph Smith, who's head of the choir. He deserves so much credit for this as well.
I mean, Ralph Schmidt has done an incredible job. He committed as an NGO to go into this community in Limpopo. He found these kids and he brought them together. He saw their talent. He cultivated that talent and has helped drive this process. And he's done so well in terms of getting these young people to America's Got Talent. I mean, if they win tonight, what does their future look like?
The sky's the limit. It's the sky's the limit. They can tour and work for the next 10 years without any problem. It'll be absolutely, you know, if you win that competition, your career is set and done and deservedly so. If you win that competition, you deserve to be rewarded massively, and they will be. So if they win tomorrow night, they've got a career for the next 10 years without any doubt, and it'll be a very, very profitable career.
And also the complexity of managing a group of youngsters like this, many of them orphans from a poor community in Limpopo. They've gone from one extreme to the other extreme of global success and global recognition. This creates as many challenges and potential problems as it does opportunities.
I don't think people understand what it takes to get a group of people like this to where they are right now. I mean, it's just people would not understand what kind of effort and dedication and time that goes into it. But they've done it. They've all done it. And it's just, I mean, South Africa should be absolutely so proud of them.
2 o'clock tomorrow morning, set your alarm clocks. Roddy Quinn, thank you very much. He is absolutely a music manager at Real Concerts. He wished he'd signed them up like so many people who've got their Christmas parties booked and don't have the Ndlovu Youth Choir. Whoever gets the Ndlovu Youth Choir to their Christmas event this year are going to get Boss of the Year awards, because these kids are going to take the world by storm. 2 o'clock tomorrow morning, we find out whether they won, came second or third. It doesn't really matter. They have taken the world by storm. They've done so well. Roddy Quinn, thank you for your professional insights. After Eyewitness News, Colin Cullis. Ways that you will watch the Rugby World Cup 2019, and we'll probably never do it in the same way ever again. Wendy Nola is here talking about technology and older people. And then the co-founder at Feltskun and how he's got Hollywood attention on his shoes, which go back a century or so. All of that coming up in the next hour here on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702. For the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that has the bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That is Africanacity. We are at Absa CIB this evening. Colin Cullis is here. We're going to talk about the Rugby World Cup. We've got Wendy Nola, who's going to raise a really interesting conundrum for the banking industry with us this evening. And then the upside of mass emigration from South Africa. If your name is Nick Dreyer and you produce a product called Veldtskoen, you've got ambassadors all over the world who are going to want to showcase your product, especially if you make it funky. And we'll hear all about that story. A guy who was once a hotel manager who's now taking the world by storm with comfortable shoes. Comfortable shoes used to be an insult. Nowadays, it's an attribute. Colin Cullis with Business Unusual tonight. Ways to watch the Rugby World Cup 2019. Will we ever watch it the way we're going to watch it this year ever again? I mean, this evolving so quickly that we actually have no idea how we watch the next one.
It's getting so good for couch potatoes. Although it is fair to say, sometimes watching something live does beat listening to it on the radio or watching it on TV. Only sometimes.
Only sometimes. Very seldom, but sometimes.
Indeed. And the thing that struck me about this is that when you look at live events, and I mean, humans have been attending live events, and you'd probably say there was a real high point with the Romans killing each other so frequently in the Colosseum 2,000 years ago, that it took almost 1,900 years afterwards before somebody said, what if I can't be there? Is there a way I can watch this without it? And so in 1911, somebody bravely said, we'll do this. They crowded about 1,000 people into a room who were fans of college football, and their team was playing in the adjoining state. And so rather than listening to the game or even watching it, somebody telegraphed the plays after each move to the other place. It was read out, and there's a big board where they then update the board with saying, well, the team's now at the 5th and 1, and the scores are now 5-0. That was the first live remote viewing of a sporting event.
In 1911.
American
football, absolutely. But then the invention of the radio made it possible then for mass audience participation in events like we'd never seen before.
Yeah, the radio was like the internet of the 1920s. And so as soon as they could get somebody with a microphone to a field and connecting to a transmitter, sports broadcast became a thing. And I think it remains one of the greatest ways to watch a sports match. I sometimes still prefer watch the actual action and then listen to the radio commentary, because it sounds like World War III is happening on the field sometimes. You look at the actual game, you think, well, it looks like a pretty average game, actually.
But you'll remember, I mean, you are of a generation that will remember the commentaries of Charles Fortune, for example, sitting at the Wanderers in this long, lugubrious days at the cricket. He was the voice of summer in those days, and of cricket before cricket was televised.
So they're still around with us. TV obviously came nipping at radio's heels. The first one, as far as I could tell, was the 1936 Olympics. It wasn't broadcast very widely. Some specific venues would receive it, but officially that was the first sports broadcast. And then, thanks to the war and other bits, TV's got a little better, a little bigger, slightly less fuzzy. But the real game changer came in 1955, color TV. It was a U.S. Davis Cup match, and people were blown away. And when I say game-changing, this is one of the few times I can actually say literally, because TV began to change the way sports got played. The first, or two for tennis, they suggested they bring in a tiebreak, because sometimes those matches could go on forever, and nobody really wanted to sit in front of the telly doing that, so they brought in the tiebreaker. And David Attenborough suggested they change the color of the ball. In 1967, the BBC, he was in charge of the BBC at the time, BBC Two, were told, you may use color. And he had the chance to do Wimbledon in 1967. And he said, gosh, you can't see this ball very clearly. What if we make it green? In fact, the ball's not green. It's optic yellow. Unfortunately, Wimbledon being Wimbledon didn't change the color of the balls. And it took the rest of the world's major tournaments to all change first before they finally said, oh, all right then. And they switched the colors. What we also got in 55 was the first instant replay and slow motion, neither of which looking anything like we do now.
But would have been revolutionary in their time.
Incredible. People say, wow, did you see what they did there? They made the plague happen slower than it was. In the 60s, we got the first text on screen. Very, very basic text on screen. South Africa sort of held off on all of these things.
We didn't get television until 1976.
And we basically came in with color because you basically couldn't do really things by then. TV broadcast had also gone to cable and satellite. And one of the big changes that happened there was for football. The 1970 FIFA World Cup featured a soccer ball that when anybody looks at a picture of a soccer ball, say, that's what a soccer ball looks like. It was called the Telstar. It was named after the communication satellite that looked a bit like it. And it's that iconic black and white octagonal, pentagonal ball.
And that's the reason why the ball looks the way it does.
It's easy to see on television. That's why they made it. And they've kind of stuck with it. No ball since has kind of had that look, but we still tend to think soccer balls look that way. But 2018, Russia's ball was called the Telstar 18. So they sort of stuck with that one. The other sport that made a change was golf. 1957, up until that place, that point, all of the majors were played with match play. The trick is you can have some of the top players knocked out in the early rounds with match play. They suggested go stroke play instead. That way we'd see all the big names right up to the last day, get more people watching the TV. And it's maybe worthwhile pointing out that TV really has allowed sport to grow and develop, and so has needed to evolve itself to keep attracting those enormous audiences, because TV rights are mind-numbingly crazy.
Now, at what point do we realize that TV rights are actually the game? I mean, the sport is nice, it's nice to have sponsors, but the TV rights are where the money is, and we're experiencing that now. If you don't have DSTV in South Africa, you won't be seeing the Rugby World Cup on the SABC. You'll be able to stream it later, and you'll be able to find it, and you'll tell us all about that. But it's all about rights. It's all about the big money to draw the game to your channel, and then you sell the sponsorships and the advertising around it.
Yeah. It runs the sports now. In fact, the US TV rights are so expensive, and the need for the broadcasters to get their money back in advertising. Initially, they wanted to speed up sports to make it better for the viewers. Now they slow it down. And sports like basketball have actual ad breaks that the teams can call just so that the advertising get a couple extra minutes of ads. Super Bowls, I mean, the cost for the prices and the length of time it takes to watch baseball games and US football games these days is crazy long, just so they can recoup that money from the really, really astronomical cost.
But also, I mean, in our now 21st century lives, who sits down and watches a game from beginning to end? I was talking to the football correspondent of the Financial Times a year or two ago, and he was saying how viewing patterns are changing. Nobody in the UK now goes to grounds and watches full games. They wait for the highlights package to come out. They see the highlights, and that's all you really want to see. Motor racing, you want to see the crashes and maybe whoever goes over the line first. Our attention spans have shortened too, so that is going to change the dynamics of the way in which we consume this Rugby World Cup, surely.
I thought so too, and was proved wrong. When cable television came out, more specifically when ESPN in 1979 said we're going 24 hours, they relied heavily on highlights packages because it was so much sport, they couldn't play all the full games, they just played the highlights. And a lot of people thought, oh well, this means the end of watching full games. It had the opposite effect. People watching the highlights were intrigued by the games, then wanted to start following a favorite team, a favorite sport, and they started watching more of it. Now, you're absolutely right to point out, the clips on YouTube, the clips on social media have people actually becoming more invested in their sport. And despite you sitting at home and chatting at the telly, you whip out your phone, you've got your Twitter and Facebook, and now you can celebrate and shout at the rest of the world, not just your TV. We're kind of getting towards some of the bigger ones. The turn of the century, so the web became a thing. Bigger tellies that went flat. No more those big box things. We had plasma and LEDs and all the rest of it, and very expensive. When 2010 World Cup rolled around, we had 3D broadcasts. I went to go and watch one in a cinema. It was amazing. I'd never do it at
home.
Was
it?
It was amazing in a cinema when you've got 100,000 rand equipment broadcasting it beautifully. Mm. Not at home. I don't think that's ever going to really take off yet. And now we sort of arrive at where we are now. 2019 World Cup in Japan. Now, if you want to find a location to have a very high-tech sports broadcast, you couldn't pick a better location than Japan. And ahead of our little chat now, I asked people, how would they be watching this particular World Cup? I gave them four options. On your home television, 54%, the majority of them, which makes sense. Lucky enough to go to Japan, 3% said yes, they're going.
I know some people who are doing that.
Okay.
Don't like them very much.
Good for
but
them.
I know some people.
And then the two I thought would be a little different. 10% said a friend with Supersport, which means you're going to have to go around to somebody who's actually bothered to stump up for the cash. 33% said streaming it. Now, I don't know if that means it's kind of a friend with Supersport and you're using logins, or I don't bother with the Explorer anymore. I just get the stream. I'd rather just stream it. And that does make sense because you get the high-resolution stuff coming off of that. And for Japan, everyone in the world is getting 4K. And in Japan, you get 8K. Now, don't remember, we've had a conversation about this.
You're going to be able to see the sweat coming out of the pores of the individuals on the field.
For somebody of our age, we wouldn't be able to tell if we're looking at a screen or is that really happening now in front of us? Is that real people? That's how high resolution this 8K stuff can get. And what they wind up doing is not that you don't just have slow motion and replays. You can zoom in on those replays. And because it's 8K, it still looks fantastic when you do. The other element they've got is more cameras than you can shake a stick at. So they're 20-plus cameras for most of the games, and then the big final games and the final, 34 cameras.
I can't wait to see it just from a spectacle point of view and how that is going to change the dynamics of the game into the future as well. It's already become so difficult to play and not to be criticized and torn to pieces, to ref these games as hell on earth. It just becomes, does it enhance the game or does it ultimately undermine the game?
Well, they become two things. One, getting it even better for you watching at home, and then start improving it for you watching it at the ground. So for getting it better at home, the other element that they're also looking to do is augmented reality. So besides the app, which is stuffed full with all of the statistics, and the screen, which has just about everything you want to see, if you aim your phone at the thing, even more stats and things will start appearing around and over the telly for you to get some more out of that game. I'm not sure if it's going to be available for us to see here in South Africa. It's certainly available for those watching in Japan. And the other element that I suppose will be pretty cool for them is they've made an undertaking with this one that any region in the any country in the world will get a version of it streamed to it if it isn't being broadcast there. So for South Africa, it is being broadcast here. You're not going to get a streaming option. But any other country in the world, if you don't have it, the Rugby World Cup themselves will ensure you get to stream it. So now we're switch to how good can it get at the grounds, because you still want people to actually go and attend at the ground. And the first opportunity over there is you, again, get yourself a new pair of goggles. These are these augmented reality ones. You're watching the game. You've got headphones on so you can follow along with the critical parts. The screens at those venues are now so big and they pretty much watch everything in real time, you know, replays, etc. So that's very good. But you'll also have the overlays from the field. So how far is that kick he's got to make? 33 meters, if I'm not guessing incorrectly. Was he offside? Yes, he was. You'll get this all from watching these with the goggles. And then it goes one step further. And when we were chatting about e-gaming some time back and the notion that esports are going to get people out of sporting venues, the sporting venues said, no, we've got a plan. Holographic projections on sports fields. So not only will you go to your actual sports ground, you don't have to worry about your team playing away. They will play at your ground, irrespective of where they're playing. Or any other match could be broadcast at your ground. And when something happens and you want to watch it in, you know, let's watch the replay, just zoom in, make the holographic images super big on the screen and watch it like that. So I think despite the Romans having thought, man, we've got it good 2,000 years ago, it's really now getting to a fantastic point, things we can look forward to. And with everything else that we've got coming up ahead of us for this weekend, the only thing left for me to say is go Boca.
Go Boca.
Thank you very much. Colin Cullis with Business Unusual tonight, a fabulous insight into the way in which you are going to be watching the Rugby World Cup in 2019. In a moment, Consumer Ninja, Wendy Nola, to scare the living daylights out of the bankers.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, now proudly brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking.
Consumer expert Wendy Nola in studio with us this evening. Wendy Nola is our consumer ninja. We let her loose on unsuspecting corporates when they're not treating people properly. And tonight she's having a go predominantly at the banks. We thought that would be a good idea.
You did, Bruce. only banks, but yes.
Because generally old people are getting left out of the economy more and more and more. And what we forget is if we're lucky enough, maybe one day we'll be old too. And you've got some really interesting case studies.
I have. So, I mean, in the olden days, we posted our checks. When I first started as a consumer journalist 21 years ago, I was issuing warnings, writing about telling people how to avoid check fraud, which kind of pin to use and how to cross and all the rest of it. Those days are long gone. But there are a certain number of consumers, older consumers, many of them our parents, who still want to use checks. And now you get penalized for that. If you want to deposit a check in a bank, in a branch, that's going to cost you a lot of money. Of course, no one's posting them anymore. For one thing, the post office is probably not going to get them there, never mind the fraud issue. But so there's that. And then you get penalized if you want to transact in a bank. You know, it's much more expensive. There are big fees for to deposit cash as well.
Sure.
And then you've got the issue of fingerprints, right? So it is a fact that most people, when they get into their 70s, they've worn their fingerprints away. So now if you want to go and apply for a driver's license, or you want to apply for a passport or an ID, a smart card, or in some cases collect a credit card from a bank, you have a problem because
biometrics require you to have visible fingerprints.
Yes. So one of the case studies is, and let me just find it here, Fran Kinnear, who is 77, she wrote to me to say when she applied for her passport last month at Home Affairs and Escort, which is in the Midlands, They couldn't get this, any fingerprints from her. So she was told, okay, you can take this letter. It's called a third-party letter, this form. Take it away. Find yourself a third party. And when your passport's ready, we'll let you know, which they did via SMS, and come in with that third party who could vouch for the fact that that does have fingerprints and can vouch for your identity.
Oh, for goodness sake.
So she did that, and they filled in the letter, and then the scanner, which had to scan this letter to Home Affairs in Pretoria, was broken, yes. And they didn't know when it was going to be fixed. And her current passport expires on the 27th of this month, and
yeah.
She needs
it's a kind of thing. It's a problem,
yes.
But also in times of deep stress and trauma, you've got a story of a widow who went, yes, to a bank to try and settle some debts for her late husband, and was then confronted in the bank by the bureaucracy of the 21st century, which says, you don't have an app for that.
And you don't have an app for that, and who are you anyway? Are you a real person? So picture the scene. She's in her 80s. She's very recently widowed. She doesn't have a smartphone, a computer. She's with the old world. But her husband, her late, her recently departed husband, had a 10,000 rand credit
credit card debt.
Thank you, Bruce.
There we go. I can fill in the gaps anytime.
I'm not going to, for obvious reasons, I'm not mentioning the names of the banks on this particular night.
Of course not.
So she...
But it wasn't absent in this particular case.
It actually wasn't absent in this particular case.
Relief all round.
So
yes.
Stay with me here, Bruce. So she's with another bank, not this bank that her husband had the credit card debt with, right? So she draws a check from her bank, and she gets a lift with a younger friend and goes to this other bank where her husband had a credit card debt and says, here I am. I want to settle my husband's debt. Here's my check. And they say, absolutely not. You can't allow you to do that. And the friend wrote to me to just say, you know, this woman, I didn't tell you this in the prep, but she had a home invasion, six guys, this woman told the bank this. Listen, can you not just be kind to this woman? She wants to settle a debt. She's got a check. She's good for it. And so I took up the case, as I do. And they got back to me just before we came on air to say, we apologize for the inconvenience, and we've now allowed her to settle the debt. But actually, it's because, I want to just read you the actual thing.
But here's a woman, while you find that, I mean, yes, here's a woman in her 80s who wants to do the right thing. She goes into a bank to settle a debt. She doesn't want a negative credit record for her late husband. She goes in. She says, I'm going to do the right thing. Here is the method of settlement. The bank says, we don't accept those bits of paper that you've scribbled on anymore. We don't believe who you are. I mean, I would personally just walk out the bank and say, well, then sue his estate, assuming that there's some money, and you run up the lawyer's fees, for goodness sake. It's pathetic.
It's this picture is sitting there in this wheelchair. So
she's in a wheelchair too.
You can't make it up. So the answer, the response is, our decision to discourage the use of checks as a payment method is a precautionary measure to protect customers against fraud and the high cost of handling checks. She was in the bank, in their bank, with her check in her hand, with ID and everything else.
I am willing, as your customer, to incur the cost of your processing this check. It's going to cost me $100 or whatever it is. Just solve this problem for me so that I can move on, please.
Exactly. And then they went on, this head of fraud for this bank, who's probably, in his 30s, 40s maybe, can't conceive of this issue, then goes on to state all the ways that she could have paid, this app and that cell phone, and not getting the point of my very lengthy query. So, and I'm sure customers of all the banks will have a similar story to that. I don't personally feel, and I've spoken to as many stakeholders as I can, I don't personally feel that the banks are doing enough to accommodate that generation of banked people.
I mean, these are people who are probably very brand loyal. These are people who have been customers of these banks for most of their lives. They are people who deserve to be treated with a little bit more dignity and occasionally just with a little bit of understanding and a little bit of sensitivity.
Yes, and one more thing if we have time.
Well, you do.
Oh, goody. Banking Ombud Rihanna Steyn, I spoke to about this issue.
Set her on them.
Well, I said, does she get complaints about this? And she said, well, no, not really. But what she does say is that there's a disproportionate number of older people, over 60s, who fall victim to fraud.
Yeah.
And specifically, the runaway fraud of now is credit card fraud. It's really on a bit of a spike. So that's when somebody from a fraudster pretends to be phoning from your bank's fraud division. We all pay attention to that phone call, and then tricks them into reading out the OTP, the one-time PIN, which allows them to then shop on Takealot or wherever they want to shop. And something like over half, 50-something percent of the victims of that particular fraud are over 60, and like 8% of them over 80. And I think, again, what are the banks doing to warn that customer base about, I mean, on their website, maybe not a grand plan, on their app, maybe not, on statements, maybe just do a little bit more to help them understand the nature of the of this kind of fraud and how to prevent.
There's a huge risk, and people are vulnerable, and if you're vulnerable, you are capable of being ripped off, and we should be protecting people from that, and banks owe it to their customers, some of whom have been banking with them for 60 years. My dad's been banking with his particular bank.
Mine too.
For a very long time.
Our fathers are both in their 90s.
Don't say that about my dad. He plays golf three times a week. He's
mine
listening.
Still drive.
So does mine. Probably better than I do.
Yeah, right. So can I just say one last thing about the fingerprints?
While you're there,
I managed to get hold of Home Affairs, which is a feat in itself, and the spokesman did tell me, the Deputy Director General no less, that they are very close to launching a whole new solution where it'll be iris, it'll be palm print, it'll be all sorts of other things besides fingerprints that will enable you to be accommodated, even for amputees and also not just old people, but there is a solution very much in the pipeline right now. So that is a positive.
Wendy Nola, thank you very much. Consumer Ninja Wendy Nola, she is unleashed every Wednesday. What's today? Wednesday. Wednesday is Wednesday on The Money Show.
The Money Show. Shapeshifters.
Shapeshifters brought to you by Worksman's Attorneys, worksmans.com. Keep them close. We are talking Veldskuns this evening, but not any kind of Veldskuns. These are registered Veldskuns. Nick Dreyer is the chief executive and co-founder of a company that has taken a shoe that was made by farmers in the veld out of raw hide and leather probably 120 years ago. I mean, people, if you read Commando, Denis Reitz's Commando, people were making veldskuns in the veld.
Bruce, it's been around for a very long time. More than 100 years.
Have you not got any contemporary ideas of your own?
Thank you.
anytime.
It's a lot easier when you've got about 100 years of brand equity.
Okay. Now, before we get to the Veldskuns and what got you there, you actually are a hotelier by trade. I mean, that's how you trade.
Yes.
You worked in the hospitality industry.
Yes. I studied hospitality management in the Cape and worked at some great hotels, the Bay Hotel in Camps Bay, and then ended up working for a long period of time at Element House in Bantry Bay, which is one of the great hotels of South Africa.
But that is owned by Paul Harris, one of the co-founders of First Rand Group,
That's
right?
correct. Okay. That's correct. And the hotel is one of those iconically South African places where you can see some of the best South African art and you can taste the greatest South African wines. And I really got a feel for, you know, the being absolutely passionate about South Africa during my time at Element House. And then, you know, went on to do some other stuff and got involved in the art world and then started an entrepreneurial journey about 7 years ago.
An entrepreneurial journey suggests that Veldskuns is not your first idea.
No, it's not. My first idea was to start an art advisory business, which didn't fail as much as it didn't start. It just turned out that there wasn't a lot of folks in South Africa that were willing to pay for my advice, which is okay. But you learn a lot in those early days building little businesses, and you learn a lot about the power of invoicing and getting actual transactions going.
Yeah, I mean, but essentially what you then stumbled upon was this idea of Veldskuns, because you weren't a fan, I don't think, of the ancient traditions of the shoe.
No, and not even a huge fan of shoes, to be honest. It was the strangest conversation. Ross Zondag, my great friend and business partner in this, he was driving around in Cape Town and I was driving back from Plet to Cape Town. And in a period of 6 hours, we started discussing how poor the South African team looked at the Olympics. That's where it started. And the conversation went something like, yo, but the Americans have got a basher and they've got deck shoes and they look so smart. What could South Africans have been wearing? And Ross said, well, we've got Veldskuns. And I said, yeah, but they're terrible. They're just not fun. And
because they hadn't really evolved. I mean, yes, they'd evolved from the smelly sort of homemade shoe of 120 years ago to a more commercial version, but they'd stayed essentially the same for 100 years.
What they had going for them was that they're loved. You know, anybody that has a pair of Felskin has a great story about Felskin. And they're known for being really tough, really hard-wearing, and like reliable and comfortable and better over time. So they felt a little bit, they felt quite, you know, quite South African, resilient. Yeah. And it just needed to be looked at through a new lens. And in that one conversation, we had a guy working for us, and we photoshopped just bright soles and bright laces onto them. And as I got the message back and saw the pictures, I thought, bang, there's something here.
And nobody had trademarked the name Felskin.
Well, that's Ross for you, because we were sitting there going, what should we call this Felskin business? And he goes, is it Nick and Ross's shoes? Or? And Ross is a pretty simple thinker. He's very smart, but he gets through to the nucleus of the problem, and he goes, let's call it Felskin. And I said, you can't call a table company Table. Turns out you can. And it's 6 hours later during this car journey. By the time I arrived in Cape Town, we'd registered a PDY Limited, Felskin PDY, Felskin Shoes PDY Limited. And we'd popped in an application to trademark the word Felskin as a brand, not as a descriptor. You know, we're very cautious that we consider ourselves the custodians of Felskin. And the custodians, not just of our Felskin, but custodians of South Africa's Felskin and South Africa's message. So it's not a hard trademark.
No, but here you know nothing about shoes.
No,
you don't care about shoes. You're not even big fans of the shoes. But you kind of figure I can make these things look better than they look right now. You've got no idea about the shoe market. You've got no idea how the distribution systems work, how the manufacturing works, whether anybody in South Africa would even put a neon yellow sole on a Felskin for you. At this point, you have no idea. You've had 6 hours of theoretical conversation.
Yeah, even worse, we figured we'd start an e-commerce shoe business, and neither of us had any experience in e-commerce, almost not even from buying on e-commerce. So we set off for about 3 or 4 months immersing ourselves in learning how to do this. But we had our day job. So this stuff happened between 10 o'clock at night and 12 o'clock in the evening. And Ross and I learned how to build an e-commerce site. And we had to go out and find a manufacturer and ensure that the quality was right. And it was nice and small, so we didn't have to think about things like scale, which came later. But we got really hands down into the product and built out a really cool product. And once we'd learned how to sell some online, they started selling. And when we started to learn how to advertise digitally, folks started talking about us online. And that was the moment when we met our third founder. We didn't meet him. He's actually a schoolmate of ours. All three of us went to the same school in the same year. Nick Latouf, and he had a digital agency just starting in Cape Town. And he was the first guy to be quite supportive of the project. The rest of the folks that we'd spoken to had found it quite comical, including our wives at that time. And Nick was, I think, the first guy that saw value in it, and we immediately said, would you like to join us as a shareholder?
We need some money. Because, I mean, you literally, I mean, there's the term bootstrapping. You could maybe coin the term Felskin strapping, because you started this business with nothing.
It was a challenge that Ross and I set ourselves right at the beginning. We wanted to see if we could do it ourselves. And you know, we meet a lot of young people now that are starting things, and the one thing we can tell them is you don't have to be suited for your idea. Your skill sets don't have to be absolutely aligned with what you want to achieve. But what you do have to do is you have to endeavor. You've got to endeavor to learn how to do every single little piece. But in doing so, not only do you get your hands on your own business, but that incredible expense line on your future profit and loss is as low as it can possibly be. And that's the best way to start. And we started that, A, as a challenge, and B, we really wanted to learn how to build this business. And we set out to do so.
Tell me about the manufacturer. I mean, do you still use the same manufacturer? Are you manufacturing yourselves now? How did that relationship evolve?
Yeah, so we went through a couple of manufacturers to try and get the product right, and then we settled upon one and then scaled that out a little bit. And then we moved on to a wonderful, wonderful team in Durban called Hopewell Shoes. And we've worked very closely with them. They were the best fit for us in terms of being able to scale into the future, because we realized early that there was an opportunity here to create a global shoe market for Falcon, and you needed you needed the right partner in terms of manufacturing. But they're an 80-year-old, second-generational business that has made shoes in South Africa for a very long time. They do an iconic job, and there's two things about making stuff in South Africa that we really like. A, you can't make Falcon somewhere else.
No.
Okay, so you have got to make it in South Africa. But the second thing is the great advantage is if there's an issue with our thing or just with our new retail relationships, I can hop on a plane and I can shake hands with Mohammed and we can go through the process together. And that's a huge advantage.
Absolutely huge advantage. When did you get the idea that this has got a global application? Because, I mean, they were kind of trendy in Zimbabwe amongst a certain group of young Zimbabweans at one point. Then kind of lots of Afrikaans people may have worn Falcons. And if you had like a farming bent and if you went to Sadara in KZN, maybe you would have worn Falcons. What gave you the gumption to expect that there would be people like Ashton Kutcher, for example, Prince Harry, and Mark Cuban, the great entrepreneur, who would actually think to themselves, this is brilliant?
Well, it's a great question. It came early that two things happened. One, we were diving into the online shoe market in America, and we came across an amazing business called Allbirds, who make sneakers out of merino wool.
Yeah, we've spoken to them. They do wool shoes.
They do wool shoes, and watch this space. You know, South Africa is going to be starting to produce a lot of merino wool. So what, you know, as a material, it's incredible. And then what they started about a year and a half before us and scaled up really quickly. So we knew that there was this appetite for online shoes, and there was this space that we could move into. But the second thing that happened is when we learned how to build an e-commerce store, learned how to build our own fulfillment services and all the rest of it, why can't you do it in England? And why can't you do it in America? Because we'd just done it. It was as easy as getting on a plane, sitting in a hotel in London and building an e-commerce store. And by the time we'd got there, we'd learned how to do it. So why not? And we knew that there was enough South Africans that would give you a little bit of traction. We know that the shoe at this point has got great word of mouth. So it was cheap to start. To start an e-commerce store in the UK, we did that in the first 6 months.
How many pairs have you sold in the last year?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think about 20,000 pairs.
20,000
in South Africa.
What's your target for next year in South Africa?
In South Africa.
Globally?
Maybe up to about 25,000. Yeah.
What's your target for next year?
100.
Nick Dreyer is the highly ambitious chief executive and co-founder of Falcon. We're going to talk to him about a new contract. We've been very critical of Woolies on this program because Woolies have had a propensity to copy other people's ideas. This time, however, they're not doing it. They've actually bought in Falcon. We'll talk about that relationship in a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that has the bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That's Africanacity.
How often have you seen somebody come up with a really great idea and you thought, but I had that idea 5 years ago. I didn't. And that's the experience that Nick Dreyer has had, the chief executive and co-founder at Falcon. The picture you're painting is a picture of the easiest entry into a business in human history. It can't have been as easy as you suggest. You're kind of going, we're kind of a couple of bumbling oafs who got together and we built a website. We created an e-commerce site. We didn't know what we were doing, but we did it anyway. We couldn't make shoes, so we found a guy to make them. You make it sound incredibly easy. It surely can't be.
It's not that easy, Bruce. I mean, the one thing we're not talking about is the amount of hours that went into it.
Yeah.
The amount of sacrifice in terms of time in the first 6 months was severe. But it was easy for us because we were enjoying what we were doing. Nothing about it felt like work. Everything about it felt like an adventure, and it felt like this is going to sound a little bit philosophical, but we felt as if we were doing a good thing in South Africa, because all of a sudden we were starting to see our audience respond to the fact that we'd put a new lens on something, and we were championing all the like great stuff about South Africa, the J Bay shoe, the Pinotage shoe. And you know, I had Bayers through to phone me and say, don't call your shoe Pinotage without phoning me. but we had all this wonderful energy. So the hard work, you know, it's obviously there.
At what point did you give up your day jobs?
About 6 or 7 months in, there was a great moment at the first Long for Life conference where the descriptor of our investment said, we found these guys in a three by three meter office in Woodstock. And it was exactly right.
How did that happen? Because you have as a big shareholder, you have Brian Joffe, who is the founder and chief executive of Long for Life. How did that discovery happen?
So they found us. I think it was just through the interest of the shoes. We were highly visible. They got in touch with us and said their mergers and acquisitions guys came and said they'd like to talk to us. We sat in an office. We spoke about our plans. We were very, very focused in what we wanted to achieve. And I think they identified with that. In choosing Long for Life, we were very, very cautious in terms of...
Had you had other approaches? I mean, were some financiers sniffing around? So these were the first guys who came along?
These were the first guys that came along.
It's like marrying your first date when you're 16, isn't it?
Yeah, but so many things in this business have happened like that. It really is. It's a blessed business when the right things have happened at the right time. What we wanted was retail. At that point in the business, we needed retail, but we needed a little soft landing in retail. And Long for Life had just, you know, their lifestyle retail. They've got great products like Sportsman's Warehouse, Outdoor Warehouse, and Sorbet.
And it was Feltskin,
and it was a really great fit because we could get into our first retail experience with Outdoor Warehouse, and it was, you know, retail's a tough game. You've got to learn how to do that, and they were very patient with us while we learned exactly how to do everything, and we built it, and we knew that if we could do what we do, which is the digital storytelling part, we could drive sales in Outdoor Warehouse, and it has happened, and they've done an amazing job of working with us.
So often, though, you've got three people who are partners in a business. A funder comes in and starts having a conversation. One of you is going to have cold feet. One of you is going to be nervous. One of you is going to be apprehensive. One of you is going to start second guessing the others. There's going to be tension. Or were you all like, "Hey, somebody's interested. Let's give them what they want." Was it a bit Dragon's Denny that way?
No, not at all. It was quite analytical. The one thing we did know is what our path was. We knew what we wanted to achieve in Feltskin.
What was the goal? What was the
goal was and still is that we want to create South Africa's most iconic apparel, something that is uniquely South African, not just for South Africans, but for everyone that visits South Africa.
Yeah.
And to achieve that, you can't just talk to hipsters and you can't just talk to fashionistas. You need to talk to everyone. So the other day I had an amazing moment. I was in the airport lounge and the CEO of a company came over and sat next to me because he recognized the Feltskin and he was wearing a pair of Feltskin. And he said, "Nick, oh, lovely Feltskin." And we got chatting for a second and we sat there and all the staff in the lounge were wearing Feltskin as well. And that made me so proud because that's what we want to do.
Why are the Global Youth Choir not wearing Feltskin?
We are talking to them and we wanted to get...
I think you may have missed that boat.
Oh my God, the Americans Got Talent's commercial rights thing is just crazy. Oh, really? I've been down the road.
Trevor Noah, why is he not wearing Feltskin or putting his feet on the desk?
We've got so many great South Africans. I'm sure Trevor, if he's out there, he's welcome to a pair of shoes anytime. But we have great, great South Africans all over the world. And this has been the fascinating thing about this journey. The minute we started, especially in America, we had all these unique South Africans that you'd never heard of that are doing unbelievable things in the world message us going, "Nick, I'm wearing Feltskin in Washington, D.C. I'd never thought I'd ever see the day." And we go and visit with them and we're in touch with them. And in fact, we're building out the business with distributors, with great South Africans that have done amazing things all over the world and not necessarily in shoes.
And they're just seeing and they're feeling that sort of sense of nostalgia and they want the roots. They want to be tied to South Africa. Tell me about the Woolworths relationship, because you are the first guys to be an outside shoe supplier to Woolworths. They usually get their shoes made by other suppliers, but they all have their own brands.
Yeah.
You're the first own brand to go onto their shelves.
It's a very interesting story. Our good friend at Investec, Tristan Farrell, she's got us in touch with Michael Coles at Woolworths, and we were having a breakfast with him. And Michael was traveling, and he's a busy guy, and he almost couldn't take the meeting. He tried to cancel it, but we managed to sit him down for coffee, got chatting about the story, and it's about the story. We were telling about what we were doing in the world and what we were doing in South Africa, and it resonated with him, and he identified with the fact that we could potentially get into Woolworths and then and be the first footwear or local fashion brand inside Woolworths.
And how does that change the dynamic of your business? Because suddenly you've got a network of orders to fulfill. and you've got to fulfill those orders.
Yeah. So
going into the Christmas season, there's going to be demand.
No, so exactly. So you need to think about scale in terms of manufacturing. You've also got to think about inventory management that becomes highly critical, you know, a critical component of the business. And we've had to upskill our staff, and we've had to upskill ourselves to be able to manage for that. And but what's interesting is this is the first rodeo for Woolworths and for us.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've been labeling shoes for the first time, because they also don't normally have an outside company that's involved with them. So it's been a really good journey. The one thing I can say is that they have absolutely embraced this project, and they have been passionate about it. They've been incredibly helpful. Their team is very professional, and we're very proud to be working with them.
They've got such a good opportunity, though, to make good on the Frankie's stories and the Baby Carrie stories, and to take South African homegrown products like your own and become partners and to help you grow your business.
Well, and I hope it doesn't end with us. You know, if we can kick open the door for a great South African retailer to partner with great young South African startups that manufacture things in South Africa, that is just a great thing. And, you know, I'm hoping that we can facilitate or stimulate a little bit more of this, because we'll increase manufacturing, we'll increase local expertise, and we'll end up making some more jobs and doing well for the local economy.
How much of the business do you guys still own, the founders?
Of the founders. We've got a 51% stake in
Costco. So you've got, you managed to get Mark Cuban on board. He's invested, yes. Has he not?
Yes, so that business is a US business. It's called Calibuntu.
Calibuntu,
California,
right.
And Ubuntu. Lovely. Together. And
and then you'll have a UK business.
So we own the UK business. We own 100% of the UK business, Veldskin Limited.
Right.
And we are, the rest of it's pretty much distribution agreements. But we're selling into Australia, the rest of Europe, and the East. We've first foray is Taiwan.
And you got the attention of Brian Joffe, one of South Africa's foremost entrepreneurs, person who's grown multiple businesses over time.
Yes, great deal maker.
Is he a demanding shareholder?
Brian is direct. And every time I go into his office, he asks me how many shoes I've sold, which ultimately is the question that, you know, that's the ultimate thing to answer.
But when you started out, your goal was sell 3 pairs a day.
Well, this is, yeah, absolutely. We knew that we needed some stranger validation. In other words, somebody other than your mother buying it. And you needed to start small. So we got three pairs of shoes selling a day for the first 2 months. It was 90-odd pairs of shoes, about 100 pairs of shoes a month. And then it grows out of that. But what we realized is that, you know, especially then the funding comes, and then the scale comes, and then finally the gray hair comes. But in those early days, what was important was to just start, just to get going. Get a sale going. Make sure that somebody can transact with money on the internet, which in a conversation sounds incredibly easy, but I can guarantee you it's very, very difficult. And in fact, you know, it's a team effort. It's a family effort. I remember my wife, Frey, sitting in a Postnet writing out waybills, maybe 50 or 60 waybills, and it took so long that the Postnet at the waterfront brought furniture for her, because she was she was 6 months pregnant. And I made her sit there for like 4 or 5 hours on the weekend every single Saturday writing out labels.
You're going to pay for that for the rest of your life. Nick Dreyer, thank you very much indeed. The founder and chief executive of Veldskin. Watch the story. It's going to be a great South African success story, taking the world by a storm, wrapping up the Money Show on this very special broadcast from the Corporate and Investment Bank at APSA. Thank you very much for having us. And thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Good luck. Chief Executive at Veldskin. That's a wrap on the Money Show for this evening. Chat again tomorrow. Bye.